This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Hello and welcome to Instant Genius, a bite-sized masterclass in podcast form. I'm Sarah Rigby, online staff writer at BBC Science Focus magazine. Joining me on this week's episode is Dr. Michael Mosley. He's a former medical doctor, health writer, and presenter of the podcast Just One Thing on BBC Sounds. He tells me all about the simple lifestyle changes we can all make to improve our health and well-being. First of all, could you please just tell us a bit about your podcast, Just One Thing?
Sure. So the idea of this podcast came from a bunch of independent producers. And what they said to me is, do you fancy doing a podcast series, which will be bite-sized? It'll just be 15 minutes ago. And the idea is that in each one, we will explore just one thing that you can do, which is kind of simple and easy and you can fit into your life, but which could, you know, transform your life or at least improve your life in ways you might not predict. And they came up with a sort of short list, which included things like brisk early morning walks or cold showers. And they seemed to me very doable. And so the idea is that in each episode, I do it. We get a volunteer, a member of the public, to give it a go as well for a week or so. And I also interview an expert in the area who knows a lot about cold water immersion or whatever it might be. And so it's partly an immersive experience and partly you're learning from the experts and to some extent from me and from the willing guinea pigs about what the experience is like. And each week it's different.
So the things, the just one thing things that you include, they tend to be quite easy, quite small things that you can do. If, for example, I have quite an unhealthy lifestyle, can I do just small things like this and get healthier, or can they really replace larger lifestyle changes?
I think what the research shows is that we may, you know, on January the 1st or whatever, come up with all these New Year's resolutions and say we're going to lose 2 stone or, you know, 20 kilos and take up a marathon. But when you have these sort of goals, they're very rarely followed through. And the more successful goals tend to be the ones where they are bite-sized, where you think, oh, yeah, I could do that. I could tag that onto my life. And a lot of it is about actually finding things you're already doing and then tagging these onto them. Because if you find it really difficult, if it's really challenging, then frequently people start and then they give up because it's too big a change. So the idea of these is, yes, they are relatively simple, but they accumulate. And that if you do them, you can make some significant changes in a remarkably short period of time. So, for example, going for a brisk early morning walk. It's something that most of us could probably do. Most of us probably don't do. But the research shows, particularly if you're sedentary, then doing a walk of any form is good. But if you can do it briskly, and in that particular episode, I also explore the power of music to drive you along so that you pick up the pace. And we look at the kind of science of being, you know, why would you want to do it in the morning rather than the afternoon or the evening? So there's more sort of elements to it. But the simple premise, you know, go for a 15-minute walk, is something which is eminently achievable. And there is a lot of science now which suggests that doing something as simple as that, particularly, as I said, if you're starting off from a very low base, that can make a significant difference.
So you're on your second series of the podcast now. So you've got, you suggested quite a lot of different lifestyle changes that I can make, but I think I might struggle to incorporate all of them into my life in one go. So if I am going to choose one, how would I go about choosing one from all of the topics that you've covered?
I think one thing you can do is obviously go to BBC Sounds and look at the list and see which ones you fancy, basically, because you have to be willing to do it. You have to be interested in wanting to do it. And then it has to be something you can fit into your life. So that is really my best advice. You look at it and go, oh, yeah, I could do that. Or, oh, no, that doesn't really grab me. That doesn't isn't something I want to do. I'm already, for example, going out for early morning runs, so I don't need to throw in a early morning walk on top of that. But you may be someone who's got a kind of sweet tooth. You've been wanting to give up some of the more obviously sugary stuff. You're eating a lot of buns and you think, oh, I could try the dark chocolate challenge. And you'd kind of dig into that and you look at the science around that. And I certainly find that if I have dark chocolate in the house and we do explore the sort of science around dark chocolate, because it's less sugary, and because it's richer in cocoa and because it's richer in flavonoids, then I am less inclined to eat lots of it. So if it's a bar of milky chocolate, I'll eat the whole thing. But with dark chocolate, I'm quite happy to take a square or two. And that's that, you know, I can put it aside and forget about it. Whereas I really, really can't do that with the milky stuff. So it's a way of changing a particular habit. And hopefully over time, your longing for the other stuff will fade. But I have to say, with me, it's taken a long time. I still feel the longing, but I just have replaced it with a different thing.
So as you mentioned earlier, on each episode, you get a member of the public in to test out this thing. Whose life has changed the most over the course of the experiments that you've done with them?
Interesting. I'm not entirely sure. They had different sort of goals. In the case of the chocolate, we had a nurse who was very keen to lose a bit of weight, get a bit healthier. She spends a lot of her time, as is often the case when you are working in a hospital, there's the patients leave you sort of big piles of chocolate and gifts and things like that on the station, and you wander by and you munch them down. And she found that simply substituting it for dark chocolate did make quite a big difference. And she was very enthusiastic about that. She lost some weight, but she also found that her sweet tooth diminished. On the other hand, we had a guy who was very keen on, he's a goalie, and he wants to be a he's amateur. He's a goalie, but he wants to be a striker. So I got him to spend a while doing a sort of visualization technique, which is in one of the episodes. And he has become a sort of a goal-scoring phenomenon since that episode. So I think he's very grateful for it. But each person has sort of derived benefits in different forms.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that he did end up getting his dream of being a striker. I can sometimes be a bit lazy. And so if I want to do one of these things that will improve my health, can you recommend to me one that is really, really easy? What is the easiest one of your suggestions?
Okay, probably the easiest one of the suggestions is to buy more houseplants, in the sense that, you know, it doesn't require, well, you have to water them. I hope you're able to do that. So, and that was kind of a really fascinating episode. I have some houseplants, but I went out and bought a load more afterwards. And the reason for the houseplants is there's a lot of evidence showing that having houseplants, particularly around in a, you call them houseplants, it could be office plants, but basically having more brightly coloured plants and things like that around your office or around your home, they make you feel better just seeing vegetation in the house, but also they help to absorb and scrub out some of the volatile chemicals which our houses, and particularly as we go into winter this and we lock all our windows and doors and, you know, huddle up indoors, this is quite a big thing. Furniture exudes some of these things. And the other thing is that it gets drier during the winter months, particularly we've got central heating on, and we know that will also dry out the sort of mucus in your airways and in your nose, which will make you more vulnerable to infection. There are a lot of nasty bugs going around at the moment, not just COVID-19, but the flu, some pretty vicious cold viruses hanging around as well. So having a few houseplants around helps to humidify the air. So that could keep your mucus in good slimy form. On top of that, as I said, there's just psychological thing about it. And it's just nice as well having them there to chat to and nurture a bit. So go for the houseplants. That's certainly probably one of the easiest things you can do.
Yeah, I do like having houseplants. I find it kind of stressful sometimes. You know, if one starts to die, then I get a bit too worked up about it. And I'm like, what am I doing wrong? But it's also, it's easy to feel really proud of yourself when it starts to grow, or when it gets a new leaf or it starts to flower.
Absolutely. And you can share it with other people. Years ago, I was making a series called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. And one of the things that really surprised me there was we were looking at air pollution. And there was some research which suggested that silver birch trees are a very good way of trapping the sort of microparticles that come out of lorries and buses and things like that. And so the producer suggested that we get these houses on quite a busy road and we plant birch trees outside in pots. And I thought, this is ludicrous. A few birch trees are not going to make any difference whatsoever. He persuaded me otherwise, and the academic said that she believed it might work. And indeed, we did that, and we sort of swabbed the house beforehand and swabbed the house 3 or 4 weeks later after the birch trees had been outside. And we did see it had led to a significant drop in the sort of particulate matter that had sort of come in through the windows and settled on the equipment and stuff like that. So just having a few more trees around seemed to make a big difference. So houseplants, obviously not as big as birch trees, but if you get enough of them, then as long as you don't get too stressed by them, it's supposed to be a sort of, you know, pleasurable activity. But, yeah.
So how do plants actually absorb air pollutants?
Well, it seems to be to do with the sort of the surface area of the stoma that, as I understand it, and I'm no expert on this, which is why we always get an expert in, that what they do is they trap, and particularly on the fine sort of hairs sometimes on the plant, they trap some of these particles. And when you sort of water them, they get sort of washed away. That's certainly what seems to happen with birch trees. The other thing that having a few more houseplants can do is also have a sort of small but perhaps significant effect on the carbon dioxide levels in your room. Because again, if it gets a bit foggy and things like that, then plants will be there pumping out a bit of oxygen. Though you need to keep them in a sort of a nice space where they are getting in decent light. I think on that particular episode, they give you the names. I can't remember the names of the plants that our expert was recommending. But she said you need kind of vigorous ones that grow quite readily and which love a bit. They generally love a bit of light. But the Royal Horticultural Society is a good place to go if you're wondering what sort of houseplants I should be having.
So do you think you would notice the difference in air quality?
I don't know. Certainly the studies that our expert were talking about were largely carried out in office buildings. And what they did is they were looking at more psychological aspects. So they were looking at productivity, they were measuring well-being, they were measuring things like that. And in one of the experiments, what they did is they put the plants there, left them there for sort of 4 months, and then they took them away. And people got really quite upset about it when they went away. They didn't realize they were going to miss them. NASA did an experiment years and years ago in which they put houseplants in a capsule. This was on the ground to see the impact of that. And it did indeed seem to make a difference to the air quality. But whether up in the space station they currently have houseplants, I haven't noticed any. But I suspect it's probably a bit tricky and they have other means of keeping, their air properly filtered. I suspect with houseplants, most of the benefit comes from the sort of the joy of having them around, with some impact on things like carbon dioxide levels, and also some effect on hydration and some effect on air pollution levels.
So do you think that's related to studies that sort of suggest that we tend to feel happier and more relaxed when we get to look at nature and green spaces?
Absolutely. And that was another episode we did, which was spending time in green spaces. That was in the first episode. And the Japanese have an expression for it. They call it forest bathing. And the idea is that you go and, again, you spend time in green spaces. It could be a wood. It could be a park. They haven't yet explored blue spaces, i.e. spending time down by the sea or by a lake, but I suspect it's the same sort of thing. The added benefit of trees is that they produce a range of volatile chemicals, which we seem to enjoy, which would kind of make sense since we have a sort of, you know, our ancestors would have been spending quite a lot of time in the trees, very remote ancestors. We know, for example, again, another study showed that spending time in green spaces, particularly in forests, was associated with increased production of natural killer cells. So it could well be that, doing that would help benefit your immune system. And again, there's a strong psychological component to it. And I like it. I mean, I love woods and things like that and open spaces. And I'm very fortunate because we're kind of near a wood. And so I can combine several things in one go. I can get up early. I go off. I go for a run or a walk with the dog through the wood. I'm walking briskly. I'm getting my 100 to 120 paces a minute. And I'm also spending time sort of sniffing the trees as I go. So you can knock off quite a few just one things in one go. And that's a good thing. You can combine them with other stuff. So it all adds up.
And so another one you could actually add in there was one of your episodes is about getting more sunlight, which sounds a bit counterintuitive to me, because I thought we were supposed to try and sort of reduce the amount of sunlight we get, especially in the summer months, so that we don't, you know, get sunburn and things like that.
Yeah, so there are two different elements to it. One is early morning exposure to light, which is about resetting your internal clock, because we know that sunlight is, particularly early morning light, is very good for resetting the circadian clock. That also should help things like sleep. But pretty well everything is driven by the clock, or at least the series of clocks that exist within you. And they are triggered by a number of things, but light seems to be one of the most important things. But then there's sort of exposure to ultraviolet light, which is kind of more sunlight, which is more what you're talking about. We were talking about it in the context of two things. Really, one is vitamin D, and the other is the impact of sunlight on mood and also on blood pressure. And they seem to be independent effects. So what I was recommending in that particular episode was in the sort of summer months, or the spring and summer, and that's really between March and about September. The British sun is a good source of free vitamin D. And you go out there for about 10 minutes with your sleeves rolled up and your socks rolled up, probably more like half an hour if you are Asian or Afro-Caribbean ethnicity, because darker skin takes longer to generate vitamin D. And that seems to be enough. 10 minutes is kind of enough to generate vitamin D without burning. And there is a sort of a view which says that we have got a little bit too concerned about the impact of ultraviolet light on our skin, that clearly going out there burning, going red, peeling is not a great idea. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are chronically vitamin D deprived, and that's because they spend a lot of time indoors. Because you can get vitamin D from things like oily fish, but frankly, you're unlikely to get enough. And so the majority of it comes from the, you know, reaction of the sun on your skin. And by the depths of winter, it's, particularly if you are, Asian ethnicity, then something like a quarter of Asians or people with an Asian background are either chronically or seriously depleted of vitamin D. And we know vitamin D is important for a whole range of things. So that's kind of why we were doing the episode giving you an opportunity to store up a bit more. Unfortunately, by now, by October and November time, it's too late. that the British wind, the expert I said, look, in theory you could. If it's a bright sunny day, you strip down naked and stand outside in the garden for a couple of hours, you might be able to generate some vitamin D. But to be honest, I don't think many of us are going to be doing that. So it's a bit too weak. So it's either the sunshine holiday abroad or it's eating or more oily fish, but probably it's supplementing. And the NHS now advises pretty well all adults to supplement between October and March. And if you have a darker skin, they actually recommend you supplement all the way around the year. And we know the vitamin D is so unbelievably important because it is, probably one of the best explanations for why our ancestors had darker skins. They came from Africa. When they came to Europe, when they spread throughout Europe, they became paler. And that was almost certainly because, as you head north, then you get less vitamin D or less opportunity to generate vitamin D. And with the sole exception of the Inuit up in the north, the further north you go, the paler people get. And the reason, or at least the theory as to why the Inuit are not pale, is because they get their vitamin D from fish and from blubber and, very other rich sources of vitamin D, which most of us don't have access to. So something which could actually, change skin color or drive the changes in skin color is obviously really rather important for our health. It's particularly true of women who need a lot of vitamin D, particularly during pregnancy and periods like that. But again, we know vitamin D important for bones, important for immune system, important for a whole load of things. So yeah, I'm afraid you've missed the opportunity to get a free supply of vitamin D now, but come next March, get out there in the garden, roll up those trouser legs and those shorts and go and get some free stuff.
As you mentioned, the NHS does recommend that we supplement vitamin D. But what about other supplements? Should I be taking, say, vitamin C? Or, when you go into a pharmacy, there's whole shelves and shelves of different supplements you can take.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm generally very cynical about supplements and I don't take anything. I take some vitamin D. It obviously depends. I try to get to the bottom of how common vitamin deficiencies are, because obviously on the whole, taking vitamins, if you've already got sufficient vitamins, is a complete and utter waste of time. Your body will, pass them out. There is some evidence for zinc for the cold. There have been a number of randomized controlled trials showing that if you take zinc tablets, it will cut the duration of the cold by about 2 days, from 7 to 5. Vitamin C, not really worth it unless there are a subgroup of people who seem to benefit from vitamin D, C supplements, and they are marathon runners and extreme sports people. They're the people who, for whatever reasons, if they get a cold, then they do benefit from taking vitamin C. The rest of us, no. But what's very difficult to get at the bottom of is just how common insufficiencies and deficiencies are, because they're not really measured. We were always told at medical school, doesn't happen, the diet, it's fine. But the reality is when you start looking into it, it's generally not fine. So, for example, we know that women between the ages of sort of 20 and 55 typically high risk of iron deficiency because of menstruation and things like that. We know that if you're vegan or indeed in vegetarian, and a lot of people are going that direction, high risk of iron deficiency, and particularly a vitamin B12, folate deficiency, very high risk of that indeed. Because you don't get it from your diet very much unless you're eating, there are not many. Yeast is one of the few sources of vitamin B12. Most of it comes from meat. And otherwise, there are things like zinc, as I was saying, which you can be a bit deficient in. The other thing is, surprisingly enough, that if you are overweight or obese, and obviously significant section of the population are increasingly so. There have been a number of small studies, I saw one recently in Australia, showing that they tended to be deficient in a range, quite a large range of vitamins and minerals. Not vitamin C, that's what everyone seemed to have a lot of, but vitamin D, magnesium, iron, selenium, and a whole range of stuff. And so they were suggesting, the researchers were suggesting, that this could also be kind of driving appetite. Your body is aware it's deficient, and so it's reach, particularly true for calcium. There seems to be a specific appetite for calcium. And in, again, in this population, they seem to be deficient. And again, one of the things about moving to a vegetarian or vegan diet is that the sources of calcium are not as obvious as they are if you're drinking cow's milk or something like that. So a lot of deficiency in calcium. And again, you know, it's a really complicated and utterly fascinating area, and I could rabbit on about vitamins and minerals for hours. But the danger is there just isn't the data there at the moment. And it's kind of really weird because another thing is, for example, a lot of vitamins people get now come from supplements, well, basically from fortified cereals. So cereals, they bung in lots of extra stuff. And I was talking to a nutritionist and I was saying, look, these sugary cereals are not terribly good. Why are you advising kids eat them? And she said, basically, if they didn't get the vitamins from the cereals, they wouldn't be getting them from anywhere in their diet. So I hold my nose and they can sort of knock back the sugary, chocolatey things. But at least amongst that, they're going to get something. And that's a kind of rather sad indictment of our food system, that people are getting, you know, a significant amount of their vitamins from bread, from flour, from fortified stuff, rather than from fruit, vegetables, or whatever it might be. And that's kind of sad. But I was pleased to see they're going to start fortifying with folic acid. They've just announced that's the latest thing they're going to do. Because, again, we know that's linked, particularly in pregnant women, to a very high risk or an increased risk of neural tube defects. And I've been banging on about that for 25 years. I did a film about it 25 years ago saying it's about time we did it because lots of other countries did it. And lo and behold, 25 years later, they've actually eventually done it.
We've talked about quite a few different lifestyle changes here, and you test them out, don't you, as well as the member of the public?
Absolutely. Some of them I've kind of already been doing. Some of them I give a go in a way I haven't done before. So I'd sort of half-heartedly thought about having cold showers, but it wasn't until we decided to do the item on cold showers that I thought I'd better give it a go. And one of my sons has been doing it very enthusiastically for about a year now. And he impressed us all by going for a swim in the Thames on Christmas Day. So, yeah, quite. So it's never struck me as terribly appealing. But, you know, I thought it's easy in the sense that it's short and brutal and you get over and done with. And I like swimming in the sea. I've done some cold water swimming. I had a really sort of odd incident, which I could tell you about, but cold water swimming, and that which falls into some of the downsides of cold water immersion. But yeah, I absolutely started to embrace the cold shower, and here I am 6 months later, and I'm still doing them.
So were there any of these changes that really surprised you by how much they worked?
I think the one that, a couple of things. I mean, yeah, you know, with the cold showers, I was surprised by how quickly I adapted to them. I do actually feel sort of braced. I do feel kind of cheerful. I do feel invigorated after the cold shower. I only stay in for about a minute. And the way my wife who does them, she just kind of endures. So the idea is you stay in there for long enough so that your breathing slows down. So you will start to hyperventilate. I go in, start off with a warm shower, and then I kind of wash myself in the warm water, and then I turn it on to cold. And then I sing heartily for about 45 seconds to a minute, and then I emerge. Whereas Claire just kind of stands there and just sort of embraces the cold. Now the benefits they're not very, very clear, let's put it that way. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence about the benefits of cold water in terms of things like depression and anxiety, and there are people who swear by it, and there is, as I said, quite a lot of anecdotal evidence around there. There is one randomized controlled trial looking at the impact of it on your risk of getting a cold or the flu. And that was done in Holland, and it was an online experiment, which I think had about 2,000 or 3,000 people take part. And they were randomly allocated to either continuing having a sort of warm shower every morning or a one-minute cold shower I think it was 30-second cold shower, or it was a one-and-a-half-minute to two-minute cold shower. And then they looked to see how many had come down with flu over the subsequent winter and also whether they took time off work. And what they found is people having the cold shower, and it didn't matter if it was 30 seconds or 2 minutes, there was a lower incidence. So that was kind of one of the few proper studies that's been done in this area. So I haven't had a cold so far, but whether that's anything to do with the showers, who knows? I continue to do it, although it doesn't necessarily get easier. But I was swimming in the sea last weekend, so clearly my tolerance to the cold, and that was sort of mid-October, my tolerance to cold is obviously reasonably high.
Okay, thank you. And we'll talk about the science of that a bit in the next episode. But just to wrap up on this episode, I'd just like to ask, if you had to recommend three of these lifestyle changes to the whole population, which three would you choose?
Okay, I think I would go for the brisk early morning walk. I think the benefits of that, particularly if you can do it in green spaces. I would also recommend that you drink more water. So we went into that one, and the recommendation was essentially to drink a glass of water when you wake up, a glass of water with each of your meals. I found that, it fills you up a bit, but I thought I was drinking enough, and I probably wasn't. And the recommendation is, how do you know if you're drinking enough? Well, basically, you should be weeing 6 or 7 times a day. So that's my new rule. Along with 5 a day, you should be going for 7 a day, 7 wees a day, that'll do you. And the third one is probably the press-ups. We explore the science of press-ups and particularly resistance training. But I won't say I like doing press-ups, but I'm quite good at them. So I stick to them. And again, there was an interesting study done in firemen, or fire officers rather, where they showed that those who could do about, more than 40 press-ups in their 30s, their risk of dying of a heart attack 20 years later was significantly lower than those who could manage less than 10. So the press-up or the push-up, depending on what you want to call it, it's kind of one of the best all-round exercises you can do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Instant Genius. That was Dr. Michael Mosley. If you want to know more about the health hacks we've discussed in this episode, check out Just One Thing on BBC Sounds. Or to learn even more about the easy ways to improve your health and the scary experience Michael had whilst cold water swimming, head over to the Instant Genius Extra podcast. The November issue of BBC Science Focus magazine is out this week. Pick up a copy in store or visit sciencefocus.com. Our friends over at Radio Times have interviewed Professor Brian Cox about his upcoming show, Universe. If you're interested in hearing that interview, make sure to subscribe to the brand new Radio Times podcast.